party and rain. Spin let loose or wearing thin. But biting through the shift in power leans to you, and the current is on a wheel. Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, where the time is 25 minutes before 8 o'clock. And the number to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, welcome to the morning after a rather lackluster election day. And later on in the show, we're going to be catching up with the latest election results. Most of the races are pretty well decided, but there's a couple cliffhangers still going on, particularly in the city council race between Eric Stend and a bunch of contenders. Well, actually, it's down to Eric Stend and Jenny Burdick. So we'll be catching up about that at about 8:30. But now we're going to be talking for the next hour with Christian Ramirez, who is with the National Base Building Corps. He's a National Base Building Coordinator with Project Voice of the American Friends Service Committee. And we're going to be talking about maybe like sort of a crackpot idea to send the military, to send the National Guard down to the Mexican border as a way to solve our immigration problems. And we'll be talking about some of the larger issues about immigration issues and how the United States government, the Bush administration, and the Congress is or is not dealing with that. So good morning, Christian.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about Bush's speech the other day. Actually, before we do that, why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are and where you're coming from?
Well, my name is Christian Ramirez, and I work for the American Friends Service Committee. Currently, I am the national coordinator of Project Voice for the space building aspect, which basically consists of organizing in about 20 different regions across the country with where immigration offices are. The American Friends Service Committee has, including in your city of Portland, where we have a great immigration staff, and we've been working very hard with folks there in the Oregon area to have this great mobilization that we've been having the last few weeks. So my work essentially is to coordinate the work of all of our offices that work on behalf of immigrants across the country. Formerly, I was based in San Diego and led the U.S.-Mexico border program of the American Friends Service Committee.
And so you were involved, I take it, with some of the massive demonstrations that went on May 1st and back in April.
We were. We were very much involved in those efforts. I'm currently based in the city of Philadelphia, and from here we were able to help coordinate many of the mobilizations that made history during March and April.
Well, I'm wondering what your response was to Bush's speech on Monday, and if you, as I was reading a article by Mark Cooper from TruthDig.com yesterday, and he starts out with a quote. One of the nation's leading experts on immigration policy writes that Bush's May 15 speech had, quote, nothing to do with actual border policy and everything to do with domestic electoral politics. So do you think that sums up what's going on, at least from the governmental effort to try to deal with the immigration issue?
I think that's absolutely accurate. Obviously, Mr. Bush was speaking to his Republican base, to folks who have promoted anti-immigration legislation in the House of Representatives and currently in the Senate. And it's obvious that the White House wants nothing to do with resolving the immigration phenomena, but rather is using the immigration debate as a political bargaining chip in order to secure the successful election of the Republican Party in this midterm election. It is very dangerous, however, for President Bush to be playing politics with a very sensitive issue, especially when he has announced that he will be deploying 6,000 National Guard men and women to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, though he says that he's not militarizing the border, what is your feeling? Even though they say that these National Guards people will be invisible, we won't see them. They'll be in offices somewhere on the border working at computers and driving trucks. But do you feel like this is, in fact, trying to escalate a potential militarization of our border with Mexico?
Without a doubt. Listen, I lived on the U.S.-Mexico border. I grew up on the U.S.-Mexico border. I have seen the ill effects that militarization has on communities along the U.S.-Mexico border. Currently, we have over 9,000 Border Patrol agents on the U.S.-Mexico border. A small example is the small town of Douglas, Arizona, where a population 14,000, where close to 600 Border Patrol agents are stationed. We're talking about one agent for every 30 people that live in that town. And that is the same situation is repeated over and over again against small border towns across the 2,000-mile international divide. Having the National Guard there is exactly militarizing the border. I do not know how the White House could say that they are not militarizing the border when we are deploying troops that have served in Iraq, that are currently serving in Afghanistan, and that they are trained to operate in combat situations. This is without a doubt, the militarization of the border, and it's escalating the tensions that already exist there. This is the largest deployment of National Guard to the U.S.-Mexico border in close to 100 years. And this is something that is very dangerous. We should not be playing politics with our military, and the military has no place in political issues. The immigration debate is fundamentally in this country a political issue, and now President Bush wants to use the National Guard as a backdrop in order to increase his ratings and secure the election for the Republican Party.
Well, it does seem that he's got sort of mixed results from, or mixed response to his speech on Monday night, and we can get a little bit more into that later. But first of all, there's a lot of discussion about how there's not enough Border Patrol there, and some people, including the governors of Arizona and New Mexico, are arguing that rather than putting the money into sending the National Guard, which they think sends the wrong message and is an ineffective way to deal with border issues, that they should beef up the Border Patrol. Do you feel that there's already enough Border Patrol, or do you think it would help to have more Border Patrol?
Well, you know, it depends what we want to do. If we want to stop the flow of undocumented migration and close the borders, of course you need to send a lot of Border Patrol and a lot of military, and it could be done without a doubt. But that's certainly not what our society wants, that's not what our government wants, and that's not what the economic interests of this country want. We want to make sure that we have a constant flow of undocumented workers coming across the border. It doesn't matter if you put 9,000 Border Patrol agents plus 6,000 National Guard men and women. That will not stop the flow of undocumented migration from the south to the north. As long as we have uneven economic development in Mexico, and as long as we have a society in the United States that is becoming more and more dependent on undocumented immigrant labor, we will not be able to stop this flow. And we have to ask ourselves as a society, what is the cost of enforcing immigration laws at the border? Is it worth eroding away our civil liberties? Is it worth creating a virtual police state on the U.S.-Mexico border? Those are the kinds of questions that we need to ask. A law enforcement approach alone will not stop the flow of undocumented migration into the United States.
Well, in an article by Molly Ivins yesterday, she suggests that basically the best way to stop the all this flow of Mexican immigrants into the United States is to repeal NAFTA. So let's talk a little bit about the economic conditions in Mexico that are encouraging such a flow north of people looking for work, and how U.S. policy is actually encouraging the economic problems of Mexico.
I think that's an important point to raise, because that is the root problem. That is the root of the migration issue in this part of the world, and basically in an entire globe. Since NAFTA, we have seen a doubling of undocumented migration into the United States from Mexico. As a result of the North American Free Trade Agreement that was launched in 1994, we have seen agribusiness in Mexico completely come to a halt. We have seen more and more undocumented migrants coming into the United States. The salaries of Mexicans, the real salary of Mexicans, has decreased by over 55%. So we are looking at a situation that we are creating, indeed, the perfect scenario to force workers out of their home countries and turn them into undocumented workers so they could come and work for us in the United States. NAFTA is the number one issue that that is impacting the undocumented migration flow into the United States. And unless we resolve that matter, unless we include in the North American Free Trade Agreement labor provisions, issues around immigration and how to address immigration issues, unless we do that, really we are talking out of both sides of our mouth in this country. We cannot say, let's decrease the borders for products and money, and let's militarize the border for workers. Either we have one way, either we do it one way or we do it the other. Either we close the border entirely for everything, or we allow workers to come across borders just like we have allowed Mexican products to do, just like Mexico has allowed American products to go down and set up shop in the United States, in Mexico proper. So NAFTA must be reformed. NAFTA must be looked at carefully, because that is the number one reason why we have this huge situation of immigration in this country.
Well, I'm talking with Christian Ramirez, who is the National Base Building Coordinator of Project Voice with the American Friends Service Committee. He's talking to us from Philadelphia, and we're talking today about the new proposals on the table from the Bush administration and the United States Senate to deal with the, quote, immigration problems that we have as a response to the massive uprising of immigrants and immigrant supporters over the last couple months across the country. And if you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 14 minutes before 8 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio. Well, Christian, I was listening to a speech a couple days ago by Michael Pollan, who's an author who writes a lot about the politics of food and the politics of gardening. And he was talking about how the corn subsidies in this country have actually had a whole lot to do with increasing the amount of Mexicans being basically, well, first pushed off their farms in Mexico into the cities and then ultimately up into cities in the United States because of the fact that the corn subsidies in the United States lower the price of corn and allow farmers to dump a lot more corn in Mexico, which has really altered the farming economy there. I'm wondering if that's an issue that you've looked at and if that's one of the ways, I mean, that perhaps it's not just NAFTA itself, but also looking at some of our agricultural subsidies and the whole farm policy in this country, which has had a real negative effect on Mexico.
I think that the issue of corn is not only an issue for Mexico of economics, not only an issue of agribusiness. It's also a very cultural issue. Corn has been part of the Mexican culture since over 30 centuries ago. In essence, Mexico gave the world corn, and now we are looking at a situation in which Mexico imports about 80% of the corn from the United States. So we are looking at a country that used to be the number one provider of corn in the world, now abandoning that crop and being inundated with corn from the United States as a result of the of the subsidies that agribusiness receives in this country. And we are seeing now that the farm worker that used to produce corn and sell the corn in Mexico can no longer do that. They have to sell their land. Their land has been privatized now. They'll sell their land, and with the little money that they have, they will pay a smuggler to come across the border so that that worker could end up in the San Joaquin Valley picking somebody else's crops, or up the coast to Oregon and Washington State, picking crops along the way. This is the displacement that we are seeing as a result of neoliberal economic policies that have been imposed upon countries like Mexico. This is the result of all those economic policies that were once presented to the world as the great opportunity for developing countries to reach a first world status. And we have created a situation now in Mexico in which about 5 of the 10 of the 20 top millionaires in the world are Mexican citizens. And that has been as a result of the privatization of public services, the privatization of agribusiness. And we are seeing more and more immigrants leaving Mexico. Something like 250,000 Mexicans leave Mexico every single day. or every single year, I'm sorry. And that's something that simply has to do as a result of the subsidies of agriculture and the way that we are imposing economic policies on Latin American countries, particularly to Mexico.
Well, let's get back to some of the issues of our dependency on basically very cheap, undocumented, a cheap undocumented labor force. As an example, I was talking with this guy who's a gardener the other day who has a crew of three Mexicans who work for him. They're, as far as I know, all have their papers and all are here legally. But he was talking actually about how he had some serious issues with immigration, and it got for him down to population and that there's just too many people, period. And but I could see that there was a real disconnect between his own practices. I mean, he's very happy with the Mexicans who are working for him, and granted, they're all legally here, so he's not exploiting an undocumented workforce, and he pays them pretty well. But he also, like many other people in the gardening and landscaping business, basically rely on having a very large workforce of people coming from Mexico who also happen to be very good gardeners. So how do we start to make a disconnect so that people, or how do we disconnect ourselves from this kind of system? I mean, every day, every time I come to KBOO in the morning, I pass by a corner that's two blocks from here where there's usually somewhere between 10 and 20 day laborers, almost all of them are Mexican, you know, waiting, you know, to get find work for the day, and I'm assuming that most of these people don't have their papers, and this has just kind of become the way of life for most Americans. I mean, that they take advantage of this labor pool. That's
and I think that's the biggest hypocrisy that we have as a society in this country. I do recall walking the streets of Portland not too long ago and talking to some of the day laborers not too far from your studios there, and asking them, well, why are you here? What happened in your life in your home country that you are here now in this street corner in Portland, Oregon? And the response across the board was, we have to feed our families. You know, I don't want to be here. I'd rather be in my home country. I need to feed my families. I need to work. I cannot find a job in my home country. You know, I used to work. I used to have one of them I remember telling me, I used to have a small shop in my home country, in Mexico, and I had to close it down because I couldn't compete anymore. So this is the ill effects that globalization has had, the displacement of millions of people as a result of economic policies. And once folks come to this country, suddenly it's, well, the workers that I employed, they're not, you know, I'm happy with them. I'm, you know, I'm glad that they're working for me. But suddenly we look at that situation and we start saying, well, yeah, you know, they work for me, but they shouldn't drive a car, or their kids shouldn't go to school, or they shouldn't have access to health care. We cannot have that situation. I think that we have gone through horrendous chapters in the history of this nation in which we reduce entire working people to second-class citizens, and in which we deny them rights, dignity. And this is an issue fundamentally, not an issue of legality or immigration policy. At the core of the issue over immigration is the debate over justice and over dignity for working people. We cannot have a population, some estimate up to 11 million people in the United States who are working without documents, and have this population completely living in the shadows of society. Working people deserve dignity, deserve justice, and that's something that we are not offering to them. So we cannot be speaking out of both sides of our mouth on this issue of immigration. Either we reward and we treat workers with dignity and respect, or we really call it like it is. This is a new form of slavery for the 21st century, for the age of globalization, in which we have undocumented migrants traveling from poor countries, not only to the United States, but to other industrialized parts of the world, and we are exploiting them. And that's something that we need to really recognize, and that's something that's been absent from the debate over immigration. And fundamentally, that is what prompted many of these protests that we saw. People are sick and tired of being mistreated or being exploited, and it's time for reform and it's time for change. And we hope that we could have this dialogue in our country to make sure that we treat people with dignity and respect that should be inherent to all human beings.
Well, I'm talking with Christian Ramirez, who is with the American Friends Service Committee's Project Voice, and we're talking this morning about immigration issues and contrasting the efforts that are being made by the Bush administration to deal with immigration with what some of the real concerns are of immigrants and immigrant supporters in this country and how they feel the problem should be addressed. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 5 minutes before 8 o'clock here on KBOO, and we'll be talking with Christian for about another 35 minutes. Well, I'm curious about your response to Peter DeFazio's explanation for why he voted for the very stringent and very anti-immigrant bill that was passed by the House a couple months ago. And what DeFazio said is that the very draconian measures that were in the bill, he didn't think were ever going to actually come to law, but he was very concerned about undocumented workers being exploited by U.S. businesses and by the United States society in general. And so he felt it was really important that we put immigration issues on the table and we have some kind of immigration reform. And so this was his way of expressing that concern. First of all, I'm wondering what your response to DeFazio is in that kind of thinking. And secondly, how do we separate out the need for real immigration reform from all these measures that are coming from the right about needing to close our border and to criminalize or to punish these people for breaking the law?
Well, you know, it is an issue of exploitation. So I would see how an elected official will try to use this issue and to raise the issues of exploitation and with political maneuvers that one will not completely understand. But I would say that folks in Washington, no matter what party they belong to, are not, I'm talking about legislators in Washington, are not really looking at this issue from the perspective of dignity, from the perspective of justice for working people in this country. They are looking at it from the interest of the restaurant association, from the business, from the point of view of agribusiness in the country, from the meatpacking industry, from the construction industry. There are some really powerful interests who have been lobbying to have some sort of guest worker program. In other words, to legalize the status quo, to continue with the exploitation patterns, and to simply say, you know, now the folks that I was exploiting in the past, although they were undocumented and I was getting away with it, well, now I'm going to keep exploiting them, but now this time is going to be legalized exploitation through the guest worker provisions. You know, we need to make sure that we differentiate between what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce may be saying, and they may appear to be at this particular juncture on the side of immigrant communities, but they are there really to protect their own interests, and I think that that's really where many politicians are coming from, using the issue of immigration as a political football to particularly during this election year. In regards to how do we counter the perspective from the right and some sympathizers of the immigrant rights movement as well, who still believe that an undocumented worker coming across the border is a criminal. And that's exactly what President Bush said in his speech earlier this week, that undocumented workers were criminals. He lumped illegal aliens, as he calls them, criminals, terrorists, all in one category. We need to make sure that we try to look at the root causes of migration, that people have come to this country for many, many generations, escaping poverty, escaping persecution, and that suddenly it's not okay for folks from Latin America and other parts of the world to come into the United States. It is an issue that it's going to be difficult to look at because there's a lot of passion around it. But once we begin to communicate, once we begin to understand, to meet, to get to know these communities of migrants in the United States and talk to them, promote civic participation, and start looking at them as our neighbors, start looking at them as our colleagues, as the people who live in our cities, and we start really looking at the issue that these folks are here to work just like you and I have, you know, and our families came from other parts of the world, and we came and we set up shop here and we set roots in this country. That's what's happening here with this, with the new immigrants that are coming into this country. So, I hope that the American people really throw out that concept. Throw that concept out the window that undocumented migrants are criminals. These are hardworking people, and all I encourage folks to do is to talk and listen to the stories, and you will get a better appreciation of the heroism that is involved when one has to leave their home country to set up in a different country, in a different culture, in a different reality.
Well, I'm talking with Christian Ramirez with the American Friends Service Committee's Project Voice. We're talking to him. He's based in Philadelphia right now. And you're listening to KBOL Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. It's almost 1 minute after 8 o'clock here on KBOL. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. And I want to remind you that when you do come on the air, if you call in, please turn your radio down because we are experimenting with our new 8-second delay. And if you have your radio up, actually what I just said 8 seconds ago is going to be coming on the air before you actually get to mention your question. So please make sure your radio is down when you come on the air. So again, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
It's Chuck. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
So I'd like to just pose a couple of remarks, and then I'll hang up and listen off the phone. And I'm very sympathetic to the complaint about that it's not appropriate to criminalize people who are struggling to survive. And I'm totally with the Mexican community, the Chinese community, anybody who's struggling to exist. And I think that it's, but then here's the moral problem. The moral problem is, when does, because the logic is at what point then do we ever have any kind of a border limit? Because if it's reasonable for anybody to come in and exist in the United States, then it seems actually we should do what the socialists propose, which I think it's a reasonable thing to look at, to completely open up our borders and have no limit whatsoever. Because, so I just want to put that out there. I mean, there's a kind of there's an issue of consistency here. What kind of reasonable limit should there be? But the other thing that, in terms of who should be criticized for the current situation, is the state of Mexico. Because the state of Mexico, as is just acknowledged, has now this a big growth in billionaires. And so the reason many Mexicans come to the United States is simply economic existence, survival. And so I'm not kind of on the fence about this, and I frankly think that President Bush has struck up an interesting compromise. The American economy needs labor, and that's what he's acknowledging to the business community, that we will negotiate something here. He's proposing penalties for people who came in a way that wasn't consistent with the rules. And because if the amnesty is provided, then people who came in through the rules are essentially, penalized, or they don't get the full benefits of going through the rules. So there's this whole thing about following rules, being reasonable, and so on. So do you see where I'm at with this? And so I just want to kind of leave it at that.
Okay, and I'll let Christian answer your questions.
Okay, all right.
Okay, thanks for calling. And again, if you want to join the conversation, please give a call at 503-231-8187. So Christian, there's a bunch of different questions in there. How would you sort out what our caller just asked?
Well, I appreciate Chuck's concerns and comments because I think that that is an important question. At one point, does the United States say, there are too many people coming into our country? And I think that that's really an interesting question to raise. And how do we address it? I think it's complicated. I know one way that we cannot continue to do it is having this contradictory border policy in which, on the one hand, we tell people, well, if you come through the desert, if you jump through obstacles, you know, go around the Minutemen, go around the Border Patrol, and now go around the National Guard to climb through three fences, and you make that, you know, that deadly obstacle course alive, you're going to get hired. You're going to go to the street corner in Portland, and we're going to reward you with a job. And that's the contradictory policies that we have. Ultimately, you know, the perfect solution to this problem is, of course, not to have people being forced off their home countries and to have economic policies that that the United States, in many instances, has been promoting for many, many years, principally in Mexico. I completely agree with Chuck that part of the responsibility or that the Mexican government has to take responsibility of this issue, they are ultimately, you know, as responsible as the United States in not allowing in promoting the status quo. President Fox and President Bush have been meeting about this issue for many, many years. Every, you know, since President Fox was elected and when Bush was elected, they met about this issue many times. And it is evident that what they are doing is protecting the interests. Their political interests and economic interests. For Mexico, it is important to have a social escape valve, which is immigration. This is the way that 250,000 people leave Mexico every single year, in order to not create social unrest in that southern country. For the United States, it's an economic wonder. Because you have, you know, a whole population of workers who cannot get health care, who don't need to be paid the minimum wage, who can't, you know, won't be able to drive a car, and who, in essence, are there at the will of workers, at the will of the United States. So ultimately, what we need to look at when we look at the issue of immigration, let's look at the issue of economics, and let's look at how we have been promoting economic policies in other parts of the world that have this boomerang effect. We send all of our resources and all of our products and all of our agricultural products and all of the things that we produce in this country to Mexico, flood that market, control that market, displace millions of people. Those millions of people need to go someplace, and they're coming here. So I think it is a complicated question to tackle. Certainly the United States has the right, has the sovereignty to control its borders, to put a limit on immigration, but we cannot do that in a vacuum. Many of the things that we are looking at, we have created as a result of economic policies imposed on other nations.
Well, I'm talking with Christian Ramirez with the American Friends Service Committee's Project Voice, and if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. We are talking this morning about immigration issues and the Bush administration's most recent response to the problem, and it's about 7 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO. Want to remind you that when you do come on the air, please turn your radio down so that we're not inflicted with a seven-second delay that we have here. Before I take the next caller, I just wanted to ask, bring up something with you, Christian. I was just thinking about how this whole issue of needing cheap labor force is very cyclical in American history, and there was a time when Ireland played the same role in providing cheap labor to the United States that Mexico is now providing, that Ireland needed the escape valve there was famine in Ireland, there were too many people, and so many, many Irish came to the United States. And I understand until quite recently, the largest number of undocumented immigrants in the United States was not from Mexico, it used to be from Ireland. So this problem has continued from like 150 years in Ireland. And then my own grandparents, all of them came over from Eastern Europe at the turn of the 20th century, and at that time they didn't need visas and the whole process to get into this country. My grandparents fortunately didn't wind up in the sweatshops in the Lower East Side of New York, but many of my friends' parents, grandparents actually did. And there was like this whole sweatshop economy in New York and Chicago and Boston and a lot of actually cities on the West Coast as well that just used this whole flood of Eastern European and Italian immigrants that were coming in at the very beginning of the 20th century. So then these workers weren't needed anymore. They seemed to become a threat, or they were organizing unions and doing things that were upsetting the status quo in the United States. And so in the early 1920s, that's when we started putting a lid on immigration. So I'm wondering if we can look at this historically and see the patterns that are going on with Mexican immigrants now in light of the way we've been treating immigrants to this country from places that are, quote, less desirable than Western Europe, where I guess Americans believe that they all came from. How does this kind of fit into that whole picture?
Right. I'm very glad that you brought up that historical context to this debate, because I think we usually look at immigration as though it's something new, it's something that just began a few years ago. And I think the issue that you brought up, the Irish experience, the Italian experience, the experience from Eastern Europeans who came to this country in the late 19th century or the early 20th century, and the struggles that they went through. We have to just recently, I think the historic connections that were made on May 1st when this great mobilization occurred by immigrants in this country, and that the very first May Day that occurred in this country was in the city of Chicago. The first May Day in the world, as a matter of fact. And it was organized by immigrant workers from Italy and from Ireland. And they were struggling for an eight-hour workday. And as a result of that, we have that in this country today. Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants came to this country. They were being exploited, working 16 hours a day at the turn of the 20th century. And as a result of their struggles, we were able to conquer one of the most important basic labor rights, not only in the United States but in the world, an eight-hour workday. And if we look at how we mistreated workers and how we persecuted workers and immigrant workers in the past, there was a notorious legislation that was passed against Italians and Irish. It was known as the Palmer Raids, which basically raided labor unions and workers or organizations, most of them being led by immigrants from Ireland and Italy. We also have the Chinese Exclusion Act, in which we brought in Chinese immigrants to set up the railroads in the Southwest, and we excluded the Chinese for a while and deported many Chinese. And during World War II, we allowed Mexican workers. We essentially opened up the borders. And we allowed Mexican workers to come and work in the fields of California, in the industries of Illinois. And we said, the borders are open for Mexican workers because we need the labor force. As soon as World War II was over, we ended the Bracero program and began deporting Mexicans back to their home country. So this situation of immigration is certainly nothing new for the United States. The 19th and 20th century are literally filled with stories and testimonies about this constant human mobility and the response of the United States to that mobility. Oftentimes being very repressive and very restrictionist, and sometimes, like the case of the Bracero program, having an open border policy to allow Mexican workers come and work in the United States with very little restrictions.
So it seems like the policy that Bush is pushing, some people have compared to the old Bracero policy. And what are the problems that you see with, like, having a guest worker policy again?
Well, we still have... the Bracero program began around 1942, 1943, and ended in 1965. And we still have Braceros who are alive today, who are still struggling to get back wages paid. They were taxed unreasonably, both by the United States and Mexico. They were not paid in full. And to this date, there are ex-braceros, as they are called, or former guest workers who are in Mexico, and some of them still remain in the United States, who have been petitioning both the Mexican government and the U.S. government to pay them back the money that they are owed. We're talking almost 40, 50 years ago that these guest workers were exploited. Having a guest worker program only benefits the industries in which the workers will be employed in. It diminishes working conditions in the United States. It diminishes the minimum wage and labor laws in the country. This has happened in the past, and we have to look at those issues very carefully, because a guest worker program will essentially tie that worker to their employer. That worker will not be allowed to become a union member. They will not be allowed to change jobs, and we have to not repeat the mistakes of the past. The guest worker programs of the middle of the 20th century failed miserably, and the fact that we still have hundreds of elderly guest workers demanding and marching literally every single day in the streets of Mexico City, demanding that their wages be paid back. I think that we have to just remember how we treated those workers in the past, and we cannot repeat those same mistakes in the 21st century.
I think we should also look at some of the countries around the world that are notorious for their guest worker programs, like the Mariana Islands, which actually is a protectorate of the United States, where Chinese guest workers are really being exploited. And then in Dubai and Kuwait and other places, the oil-rich Emirates of the Middle East, where a lot of workers come from Nepal and Bangladesh and Pakistan, and some Palestinians. And I think actually the movie Syriana shows quite well the conditions that these guest workers live in, and how it actually is a sort of a petri dish for raising terrorists because of the really horrible conditions that they're living in. So I think that when Bush throws around the phrase guest worker, as he did in his speech on Monday night, I think we need to kind of understand what that really means. Guest is a very nice word for the way these people are actually treated when they're over here or in any of the other countries where there are, quote, guest workers. Well, I'm talking with Christian Ramirez with the American Friends Service Committee. He is the National Base Building Coordinator for their Project Voice. If you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 16 minutes after 8 o'clock. We've got about another 15 minutes. We'll be talking with Christian, so give a call. And remember to turn your radio down when you come on the air. So, hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a solution. I think that we should bring these 11 million illegal immigrants into the armed forces. We arm them. We make an army. We send them back down to Mexico. We have them overthrow that government. We have them adopt our Constitution and declare it the 51st state of the Union.
Is that a serious suggestion?
It's a serious suggestion, yes.
Well, actually, maybe Christian can talk a little bit about the elections that are coming up in Mexico. I'm not sure we need to raise our own army to overthrow the Mexican government. Christian, what is happening politically in Mexico? I understand that there may be a major change in the government in the coming months.
Well, we're looking at a very heated political year, not only in the United States, but also in Mexico. And the issue of immigration has made headlines not only here in our country but also in Mexico. You know, it is just like here, it has been a political football, so has been in Mexico. The current administration of President Fox is historic already because it overthrew democratically one of the longest standing dictatorships in Latin America, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which, by the way, was supported by the United States for a long, long time. So after a seven-year reign of that institutional party, the right-wing party of National Action, which is what President Fox is a member of, overthrew democratically that dictatorship. And now we are looking at the possibility of having yet another transition in Mexico's history, a very important transition, because we're looking at two leading candidates, one from the incumbent party, and the other one is the former mayor of Mexico City, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who has been leading the polls for the past 2 years. It is very likely that we will have, at least according to the current polls, a leftist government in Mexico, and which might complicate things a bit in terms of Mexico-U.S. relations, but it is part of the growing changes in Latin America to try to reverse the economic policies that were imposed by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. There are some attempts to do that, particularly in South America, to create regional economic blocs to for Latin American nations to help each other out and not to be so dependent on loans from international financial institutions. So this might I don't expect for a dramatic change to occur politically in Mexico as a result of the new president that may be elected, and very likely the former mayor of Mexico City may be the next president of Mexico. But this is, I think, this may be a step in the right direction for Latin America to become a powerful economic force in order to have a more balanced trading relationship with the United States. Part of the problems that we are facing of immigration has to do with that issue primarily, and it's not only an issue of Mexico anymore. It's now an issue for Central American nations. It's also an issue for Ecuador, for instance, which about a third of its population is either in the U.S. or in Europe, working as immigrants in those nations. So it's going to be very interesting. The elections are coming up in July, and we might be seeing a very interesting change in Mexico, which I think is to the benefit of Mexico, and it's definitely a step in the right direction to finally get a democratic government or continue with the democratic tradition that was started when President Fox was able to overthrow that dictatorship through the ballot box.
I'm not sure if the caller is still on the line. Are you still there, caller?
I do have one more question.
Okay.
I am the right winger, so.
You are the right winger? Okay. I thought there were more than one, but okay.
Yeah. And I am. My concern is that, or my question is, when this country becomes as poor and as impoverished as Mexico, where will they go then?
Okay, I'm going to let you go off because we've got some more callers, but I'll let. But do you have any response to that, Christian?
Well, I think it's unlikely that the United States will become a poor country anytime soon. It is the most powerful, and we live in the richest country that this world has ever seen. You know, we have a whole lot of resources, and it is unlikely that immigration alone will cause massive poverty in the United States. Massive poverty in this country and economic crises are usually caused by working people. They're usually caused by politicians making the wrong decisions or decisions that better their own interests up in Capitol Hill.
No, actually, it seems to me that the pursuit of war that the Bush administration is so fervently going after is much more likely to impoverish this country than having a number of people coming across the border. But the other thing that I'm thinking about is that if Mexico does elect a left-leaning government, that it's really the shift in Latin America is really moving towards reclaiming their own sovereignty and saying no to the United States, thinking that the United States just thinking of Latin America as a resource extraction playground, that as Venezuela claims its own oil and Bolivia claims its own natural gas and as other countries in Latin America start to follow that lead, it won't impoverish the United States, but it'll certainly make it a lot harder for us to get the kind of cheap resources exploitatively that we've been so dependent on for the last 100 years. So if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Christian Ramirez, who is the National Base Building Coordinator for Project Voice with the American Friends Service Committee. He's talking to us from Philadelphia. You can give a call again at 503-231-8187. It's 22 minutes after 8 o'clock. Good morning. You're on the air.
Am I on there?
You're on the air.
Hi, this is Alice, and I just have a comment that I'll make, and then if you guys could address it, I'll listen. Off the air.
Okay, I think, is your radio on? I'm hearing a little bit of an echo.
I'm on a cell, so okay. I'll try and make it brief.
Okay.
Actually, I was just wondering if you could speak to the parts of President Bush's speech that talked about digital fingerprinted ID and also his encouragement of state and local police forces being able to do immigration enforcement. I think this is dangerous not only for immigrants, civil liberties, and human rights, but for the community in general. And I guess that's my comment, that when we ignore the civil liberties and human rights of those that are most unprotected, we put ourselves, the rest of the community, at risk also. And I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thanks for calling. Mm-hmm. So do you have a response to that, Christian?
I think Alice is absolutely right. We have to remember that every time we deny rights to the most vulnerable sectors of our society, we put the rights, we condition the rights, and we, in essence, eliminate rights for the most vulnerable sectors of our society, we are eroding away our own liberties, our own civil rights, and all of those things that make a democratic society. President Bush not only focused his remarks on creating a guest worker program and sending 6,000 National Guard troops to the border, but he also talked about suspending the catch and release policy that in essence has been used to detain or to have been applied to non-Mexican undocumented workers, and suspending the catch and release policy, which President Bush made it sound as though this was a neoconceived policy. And this so-called catch and release policy, what it does, it allows undocumented workers who are not from Mexico the possibility to appeal before an immigration judge in their immigration situation. Many of the folks who are not Mexican who are coming here are escaping torture, are escaping persecution. We're talking about folks from Africa. We're talking about folks from Southeast Asia who are escaping the severe dictatorships in those countries. And in essence, getting rid of the catch and release policy erodes away due process for immigrant workers. He also talked about creating, or President Bush talked about creating, a tamper-proof identification card with what is known as biometric information. And this is something that will be imposed upon legal foreign-born workers in order to prove their employer's eligibility in this country. So we're talking about digital fingerprints, about eye scanners, and those kinds of things that seem to come out of science fiction movies. And, of course, the issue of giving local police, local law enforcement, the ability to enforce immigration laws. This has been that particular point has been a very divisive point for a while now in the United States. Many local police departments have opposed it, saying that their police forces are stretched too thin, and that the local police departments have really an obligation to protect and serve those local communities without regard to legal status. As a matter of fact, local police depends a whole lot on the cooperation of communities, and having local police take on the role of a federal immigration agency will really undermine the basic premise of community policing, which is something that many police departments are trying across the country in an effort to improve relations between communities of color and local law enforcement. So forcing law enforcement to enforce immigration law, just like we're telling soldiers now to be police officers in the case of the National Guard, it's simply a military approach to what is otherwise a political issue.
Okay, Christian, you have time to take one more phone call?
I do.
Okay, so we'll take one more call. And if you want to join the conversation, again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I was interested in the historical conversation you were having about immigration, and I'd kind of like to go back there for just a second, because my dad came from Italy, so I've studied a lot of the Italian immigration history, and just one thing that probably is not well known is that a lot of the people who flooded in from Sicily at the later part of the 18th century and early 19th century actually came because a fairly large socialist movement in southern Italy was crushed at around like 1880s, 1890s. It was called the Fasci, which actually the fascist movement took it over. But they actually were challenging basically a feudal system down there, a brutal feudal system. And it was only after that was crushed that they started coming here in waves, basically because their dreams for actually being able to change something were crushed. And I think that's something that we don't really look at the other side of the coin of immigration, and you've been talking about it, but like what is left behind and those real reasons for leaving. And then people come here, and they have this American dream, And then, like your caller, your guest said, the Palmer raids, you know, crushed again a lot of those, especially those Italian immigrants, because they ended up being some of the most radical, like communist, socialist, and anarchist, in like the West Virginia mines and, like you said, New York and the sweatshops.
Actually, Sacco and Vanzetti were two of the more famous of the Italian anarchists, who actually the judge who convicted them lived in my town, and his house was firebombed shortly after that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like wave after wave of the same kind of political repression, and it just gets worse, and basically that kind of resistance gets worn down. So I wonder, now we're in a different phase where the opportunities to resist are even less, and you still have the same dynamic. People come in here because of the economic machine in the United States, but they have less of a chance to really resist and challenge the system like people previously did. And I just wonder what the level of, you know, of political possibility and awareness is there. Are we just repeating the same thing over and over again and not really challenging what needs to be really fundamentally challenged, either in Mexico or Italy or here or anywhere?
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. You've got a response to that in the last couple moments that you have time to be with us, Christian?
I do. I think I have a brief, to try to be brief. We are seeing some changes in Mexico. We are seeing the possibility of having a left-leaning party in Mexico, which is important for the democratic transition in that country. We also have an independent movement that is growing, and that sadly, the Mexican government has responded violently to that movement. Just recently, there was a huge repression in Mexico, and we are seeing the Zapatista movement growing there in Mexico as well, which is a strong indication that Mexico is diversifying. It's been, at least it's attempting to be more tolerant to different ideas. In the United States, we are seeing the rebirth, or a continuation, rather, of the civil rights movement in this country. I think that civil rights is not something that only occurred in a brief, the civil rights movement is not something that occurred in a brief moment in history in the 20th century. I think it's still very much alive. It's still very much that dream of creating a just United States is still very much alive, and immigrants really captured that moment and with the marches that were held in March, April, and May of this year. So I think then I hope that we're not repeating the same mistakes. I think that we are creating a new method of struggle, a new method of resistance, and that immigrants at this point are paving the way for that to happen in the 21st century.
Well, I want to thank Christian Ramirez with the Project Voice of the American Friends Service Committee for joining us for the last hour, and good luck with your work. It's very important. I think you really helped a lot to have our listeners here in Portland understand a little bit more what all these issues are really about.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
And I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. So that we've been talking with Christian Ramirez, who's the National Base Building Coordinator for Project Voice of the American Friends Service Committee in Philadelphia. And for the next half hour, we can continue talking about immigration. I also want to talk about the elections that just happened yesterday and talk a little bit about the results. And hopefully Kathleen Stevenson will rush in with the latest results, and we'll find out if Eric Sten and Ginny Burdett are going into runoff in November, or if Eric Sten has succeeded in getting himself reelected to city council. So if you want to talk about the elections, or here comes Kathleen now with the latest election news. And the news is, there is not a full and final something or other. We still there's still some ballots to certify. They have up to 20 days to do that. The voter turnout was 35.1%, which is kind of piddling. And Eric Sten, 50.52%. So he's holding at winning the election so far, but we probably won't know about this for a little while. He has to win 50% plus in order to not have to go into a runoff in November. So that's what it looks like is happening. So we'll talk a bit more about that. And if you want to join the conversation, either to talk more about immigration or talk about the elections, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 27 minutes before 9 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. Without adding more controversy to the topic, I just want to encourage people to be friendly and open to having discourse with Mexicans who are here. I had kind of a conversation that started by accident yesterday at a favorite coffee shop, and it just kind of naturally progressed to those issues. And he was reluctant, but ultimately, with I guess kind probing on my part, he admitted that he was here about a month ago is when he arrived as a illegal immigrant, and we talked in very you know, very deep explorative on various sides of the issue, and I just want to encourage people to be brave enough to have those conversations.
Well, it also helps if you speak Spanish, actually. I mean,
well, it would help a lot, and yeah. I didn't have that advantage. But
yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, it's one of, especially since I was down in Venezuela this winter, I'm really determined to learn Spanish. I think that it would help a lot of North Americans understand better what's going on just south of our border if we bothered to learn the language of the people who live there, and I think we'd be able to communicate a lot better.
Personally, and that's something that I am interested in doing, is always interested in languages, and Spanish has been on my list for a while.
Yeah, and I'm terrible with languages, but I've decided Spanish is on my top of my list because before I came to Portland, I lived in New York for a number of years, and there you really do need to speak Spanish. I mean, a lot of people who live in New York now and even 35 years ago were Spanish-speaking. In fact, there's whole areas of New York you can go into where all the signs are in Spanish. In fact, when I was in Caracas, I had this funny feeling of like I was in this cross between New York and L.A. because both cities have such strong Spanish flavors. And it took me a little while, a couple of days to go, oh, this isn't a city in North America. This is actually, I'm in Venezuela, and
right.
Everything is in Spanish. Actually, not every, there was some stuff in English there, too. But I think that there is so much Spanish culture in this country, but a lot of gringos are very separated from it, or we isolate ourselves from it.
Maybe.
Yeah, and I mean, and I was talking with somebody. Actually, I was talking with our station manager yesterday, who was describing growing up in East LA, and we were describing the difference between being in a city like LA, which is so culturally diverse, and then both of us coming to Portland around the same time, and us experiencing like, well, this place is like a lot. It's a lot of white people here, and I think the reality of it is that Portland is a lot less white than it was 35 years ago.
Sure.
But it's still very easy because it has such a long history of having this kind of cultural hegemony that the people who are not white are not as visible to the white folks. And so I think white people in this city really need to make an effort to look around and realize how much diversity there is in the city, and that we need to include all these people in
right.
our community.
And that's what I really encourage, is just be friendly. And I mean, our conversation, he and I didn't even result in an exchange of names. It just kind of evolved, and then he had to go do his thing and I had to go do mine, and we explored some pretty deep topics in the course of about 20 minutes. And I feel better for it.
That's good. Well, I think that's a good thing to do. I mean, I had a conversation with some of the day workers who stand at the corner just two blocks
right.
west of Cape. I had this very stupid job last year where I was going around doing these Vox Pops for the NPR show Weekend America, whatever. And so I'd have these stupid questions I had to ask a bunch of people and edit it together. And I stopped doing it because I thought it was insulting to the people I was asking. But it was Mother's Day, and I was supposed to ask people, what are you doing for your mother? And they said, you know, get some, you know, culturally diverse mix of people. So I thought, I'm going to go talk to these guys. So I went down and I talked to a bunch of them. And it was very, I mean, and they were, none of these people obviously have papers, and their families are all in Mexico. And one guy spoke very eloquently about his mother in Mexico and how he was really hoping to make some money so he could send her some money this weekend. And the concept of Mother's Day in the American sense, you know, was very foreign to them. But
well,
the concept of motherhood, what's that?
Not to lessen its importance, but it's an American hallmark holiday.
Exactly. But the fact of this guy's bond with his mother was very powerful.
Yeah.
And I used him as one of the sound bites that I sent off to NPR, and I was kind of, I never did hear back from them how much they liked that one, but I thought, let's get real here, folks, you know, when we are like sort of caught up in our own little Hallmark days and understanding that there's a lot of people in our community that we need to be talking to as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's an important thing that just happened too. Not a single one of us would be here without our moms.
That's right. And then the other part of it to remember, as I was talking with Christian Ramirez, and it was really, I was really thinking about my own heritage. And all four of my grandparents came from Eastern Europe, the very beginning of the 20th century. And this is true for a lot of us here, that we are not that long ago immigrants. And then people who claim to be Americans, you know, in the long sense, well, they were immigrants too, and the only people that aren't immigrants here are the Native Americans, which for many years we kind of forced them to be refugees in their own country, and fortunately they're starting to claim the territory again and become a lot more visible. I think it's, and the other thing is a lot of the Mexicans that are coming here are also First Nation people. A lot of them have a lot of indigenous blood.
Yeah, Aztec, Mayan, Incan roots.
Right, and that I'm thinking that the right winger, as he calls himself, who called earlier, who suggested we take this, take Mexico back as the 51st state of the United States. Well, I'm thinking, well, maybe it's time to give the United States back to Mexico, since about a third of the United States belonged to Mexico at one point.
Although I don't agree with his strategy, that was the topic that was a bit controversial in my conversation yesterday, is when he put the question back to me as far as what I thought. I thought, well, I don't believe in a fence. I believe the people that are here have a right to work. The economy kind of depends on it. However, I still feel that Mexico within itself and the Mexican people need to somehow look at the situations there. But it's even more complex when you consider CAFTA and NAFTA and all those things. So.
Yeah, and I thought what Michael Pollan was saying last week about farm subsidies and how corn is this incredibly over-subsidized crop. And so the price of corn is just so low, and we can just flood world markets with corn, and that we have driven so many Mexican farmers out of business. And Michael Pollan very eloquently is describing how these people used to own their own lands and lovingly plant corn that had been, you know, in their this family tradition for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are, you know, farm workers. They're working, you know, they're undocumented farm workers in the fields in Salinas or up the Mississippi River or whatever, and, you know, working for slave wages in somebody else's agribusiness farm. And it was a very painful way to really look at what's going on, but to see that it didn't start with NAFTA. It really started with farm subsidies, and it really started with our overproduction of corn, which has really helped to destroy the Mexican agrarian economy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And the number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 20 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus and KBOO. And we've been talking about immigration issues today. I also want to talk some about the election. And so I'm going to take the next caller, and then I want to talk a little bit about my perspective on what happened yesterday or what happened over the last few weeks that we're all sending our vote-by-mail ballots in, and what it says for the future of our region. So give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I was in college about 20 years ago. I did study Spanish. I was interested in what was going on in Mexico. The big issue at the time was the devaluation of the currency, and it was sort of a financial dictate coming out of Ronald Reagan, and it was the beginning of the breaking of the dreams of a lot of developing countries, where they just found that their money and their products just weren't as much. It's a financial manipulation. We should look at our bankers and stuff and what they're doing. But I went down to Mexico, and what became apparent was that there's like zero investment in the society and people. It's the wealthy classes in Latin America hoard the money away, and then they play with it on Wall Street and their own financial stock markets, and it's all corporatized. And we should be aware of this, because you talk about how we should become like Mexico. Well, I say, hey, hold on. This is where right-wing influences come from.
I said we should be like Mexico. I didn't say that.
Well, let me just point out that it very well could be that Bush's and Reagan were influenced by the politics and economics of Latin America, and that there's an influence from the Francisco Franco regime, who was a fascist in Spain, and that I read in a book that that fascism came to Latin America from a reaching out by the Franco regime of Spain. And it, you know, we're going to have to understand very well economic and financial forces in the world before we just, accept what's going on.
Actually, I mean, a lot of the history of Latin America is much more closely tied with economic and actually military imperialism coming from the United States. That since the Spanish-American War, when was that, in 1896 or whatever, we have seen Latin America as being our sphere of influence. And in fact, the Monroe, it goes all the way back to the Monroe Doctrine, that we have the right to intervene in any country in the Western Hemisphere. And so we have basically dominated the economies of most Latin American countries since early 20th century. And a lot of the dictatorships that were in place were installed either, well, actually through, I mean, Guatemala, we overthrew a democratically elected government. President in 1954 and installed a fascist military regime there. And we've done that in several other, also in Chile in 1973 with the Pinochet regime. We really helped install Pinochet.
Well, so we didn't do it. I'm aware of this intervention. It was a thing that came about when the United States was under the control of the Republican Party around the turn of the century. You got to remember, FDR pulled those occupation forces out of there. But if you go to Latin America before the Yankee intervention, they were run like super feudal states where the common man had very little status.
Right. Well,
and that still hasn't, that
it has, we have,
by the ruling classes there has not gone away, and I think it's a threat to our society here.
Okay, actually, well, that was an inheritance of the Spanish.
The colonial masters who were even worse in the treatment of the people than is what happened here under the different waves of immigration from England and Europe. Spain was more repressive because just the model of politics at the time.
Well, actually, what Spain did was Spain saw South America as a basic giant resource field. Spain didn't come and colonize and create community as the Northern Europeans who came to the United States did. Spain saw basically the native people who lived in South America were there to be their slaves, and the gold and the resources were there to be taken back to Spain.
The people of Latin America were treated much more harshly by the Spanish masters. When Cortes conquered the Aztecs, he was given about half the land mass of Mexico, and all of the people were slaves of his feudal estate, and it's the equivalent of William the Conqueror taking England in 1066. And that's an oppressive history.
But what I want to say is that that was the initial history in Latin America. But then in the 20th century, when Latin America became dominated from the north by us, what we did is we partnered.
It's not we, though, Barbara. You want to put the guilt trip on we, the people, when it's the financial elite and the big money players that do those.
Okay,
problems.
You don't have to get quite so hysterical. I mean, I'm saying we because we are all Americans and it's our country, and
we're run by the rich.
Okay,
and we the people are run by they the rich.
Okay,
they the rich get involved in these interventions and overtakings. And the reason why I speak up on this issue of immigration is because the only way to stop the rich from running the world is to stand up and say no to them, and don't let them do their manipulations. Don't let them do their market manipulations. Don't let them push people around.
Okay.
And if people didn't come here, you know what? They could go home and build a better country, because I've been to Mexico. I've seen it. It's a wealthy place. The people are wonderful. They're hardworking. But they need to get their act together, and they need to build a democracy there. And the only way to do it is to confront the powered money classes.
And we need to get our act together in this country and do the same thing, too. Anyway, thanks for calling. I got to take a few more callers here, and the number to call is 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Viva la migra, cabrones!
Okay, I guess that was all for that one. Okay. Anyway, I'll let you know that coming up on KBOO this morning at 9 o'clock, Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace, the guest is activist Tom Hayden. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with the author of the award-winning Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. At 10:30, Andrew will interview the director of the Eden Again Project, which works to restore the marshlands of southern Iraq and Iran. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, a comparison of the current NSA spy scandal with Project Shamrock, the NSA spy scandal uncovered by the Church Committee in the 1970s, and the controversy over a new documentary film about the emergency room of a U.S. military hospital in Iraq. That's all coming up at 9 o'clock this morning on KBOO. And for the next few moments here, we can be talking about the elections, which I would like to do. So first of all, the results seem to be that Dan Saltzman won handily, re-elected for a third term in the city council. Last week we had a bunch of candidates here, and there was a strong sense that Amanda Fritz, who was the community activist in the lead running against Saltzman, was actually going to at least get into a runoff with him, if not actually win outright. Well, she thought she was going to win outright, but I was pretty sure that it was going to be a runoff between the two of them, and it wasn't even close. Dan Saltzman won about 57% of the votes, at least that was last night. Let's see if I have that. I don't have that here. But so Amanda did not do nearly as well as I think she expected and as a lot of people expected as well. And I found it actually very interesting when I had the whole the gaggle of candidates here last week and having Dan talk, because it's been a while. I think the last time I talked to him was maybe 8 years ago when he was first running for city council, and we did a panel with the candidates for that seat back then. And I, at the time when he first ran, I was very suspicious of him and was expecting him to just, as I said last week talking to him, just kind of engineer the whole water department into tubes. And it turns out that he is somebody with a very wide-ranging environmental awareness and a great deal of motivation to put his dreams in place. And so I have actually thought that he has turned into a much better city council person than I might have expected. And one thing we didn't talk about much week, which is the Diggable City Project. He's been incredibly supportive of increasing the amount of land used and protecting the amount of land used in the city for not just community gardens, but also for a certain amount of urban farming, which could include raising chickens and things like that. And I think that he's brings a very interesting progressive voice to the council. So even though I was actually very excited to see what kind of prospective candidate like Amanda Fritz would bring, because it would be nice to see on the city council people who aren't kind of insiders in City Hall, as everybody in the council is right now. And Amanda Fritz did seem like a person with a lot of know-how and savvy and a strong perspective on a perspective from the community activist perspective. And reading the editorial in the Oregonian today, I was a little sorry that Amanda hadn't won, just to sort of stick it to the Oregonian, because they were talking about how it's important that people on the city council have a vision of the whole city, as opposed to coming from the very fractured world of neighborhood organizations. Well, I think that's really a really unkind, unnecessary cutting remark to make about neighborhood organizations. There are a lot of different neighborhood activists, some who, yes, are very concerned with not in my own backyard, but many, like Amanda Fritz, who I think have a very holistic picture of the entire community and understanding how the neighborhoods fit into a much bigger picture. And it'd be nice to see more of that on the city council, though I do think, in fact, the city council represents the neighborhoods in a better way than it has in a really long time. The Eric Sten fight was something we actually talked about that last week too, a very nasty fight. I was very disturbed to see some of the kind of slanderous things being said about Eric. And I think Ginny Burdick, who was the lead candidate against Eric, was not very forthcoming about her business connections and the fact that she gets a lot of money from developers. And even though she runs on some very liberal platforms, what I am very concerned about when people are in the city council or the metro council or the Multnomah County Commission is how closely tied they are to the real estate and development interests in the area, because that can have an awful lot. This is where a lot of those decisions are made on the county, city, and metro level. And so it's nice to see people in the city council who, though I think they all probably get money, and David Bragdon has admitted to me how much money he gets from developers, but he hopes to remain independent, so he says. Debate, you know, we can debate about how independent he is now from those who give him money, but I think we've been seeing it on city council that there's been a big shift away from just kind of the business as usual that we saw under Vera Katz, as far as developers having their way, and there's a lot of questioning about the way the city's going to be developed in the future. So having the city council stay as the status quo is probably, in my opinion, not such a bad thing, because I think the city council is becoming something that we can actually relate to. So I've got some of the latest figures here, and for the city commissioner position number two, the vote is right now Ginny Burdick has 27.3% of the vote, Emily Jean Boyles has 5.47%, Eric Sten has 50.52%, Dave Lister got 13.41%, Lewis Humble 1.57%, and everybody else got less than 1%. For city council, for Yes, the city council position, Dan Saltzman got 57.58%, handily winning over everybody else. Another race that I was following closely, well, I was following all the city commission, the county commission races, and I'm going to see if I can find those here. And I think it was not a surprise that Ted Wheeler just completely wiped out Diane Lynn. Another rather unfortunate situation, I think. But Diane Lynn has been receiving a lot of criticism across the board, really from the Oregonian. And when the Oregonian attacks somebody, of course, you wonder what they might be doing right. But actually, it seems like Diane Lynn, just in terms of process and the way that she was running the commission, has raised a lot of hackles. So it's not surprising that she's been defeated. The big question is going to be, who is Ted Wheeler? And we're going to find that out. So what I've been very interested in is who's going to actually be filling the second position seat that was up for election. It was Serena Cruz's seat. And it looked like Jeff Kogan was slightly ahead with Lou Fredericks just behind. And so there will be a runoff from that seat in November. It didn't look like anybody in that race was going to actually pull 50%. So that's going to be another very interesting race, and I guess it's going to be the question of who is Jeff Kogan, because we're going to, it could be that the county commission is going to slip into a different kind of, sort of like, let's make the county run like a business, as opposed to thinking about all the other aspects of county government that are important. Well, we've got a few more minutes left. I think we've got some callers, so we'll at least take our next caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're Hello. On the air. Good morning.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hi, I got two quick comments. One about the immigration issue, just very briefly. I don't hear a whole lot of people talking about the exponential population increase of Mexico in particular. As far as elections, we need to go after the electoral process, not so much the state of Oregon, but nationally, and I don't hear a lot of people talking about that either. And I think Utah Phillips summed up quite succinctly when he said that if it was possible to make a difference by voting, they would have outlawed it years ago.
No. Well, I think that that's true much more on the national level. I think that our voter-owned elections here are promising, even though Amanda Fritz, I think, had hoped as being the first candidate who got funded through that, that hoping that she would win, and she didn't. But I think that she actually got her voice out, and I think that we're going to see more, and hopefully, I mean, it's interesting to see how uncomfortable voter-owned elections makes the Oregonian. In fact, that was one of the accusations they hurled against Eric Sten, who they did not endorse. And they condemned Eric Sten for taking voter-owned election money. And he should qualify for it as much as anybody else. I would not exactly say that the people who ran against Eric Sten, I mean, well, some of them were the unknown candidates, but Ginny Burdick, talk about, you know, being very well politically connected and being a political insider. So, in fact, I think that Eric Sten represents a lot more the non-traditional interest than Ginny Burdick did, and that's one reason why I think the Oregonian was so uncomfortable with him, because things like him really going after PGE and wanting the city to buy it, and some of the other very kind of grassroots issues that Eric Sten has been very strong on.
That brings up one other possibility, and that's, you know, in a lot of South American countries, there's been candidates winning that are taking the country more toward nationalization of resources and so on. And that's a direction we might want to consider for this country, give
right.
some of the back to the people.
Yeah, at least maybe that's what's happening in our city council. Well, I want to try to squeeze in one more caller.
Thank
it's almost
you.
Time for me to get off the air. So thanks
day.
For calling.
Bye.
And we'll take one more caller. Oh, we have no more callers. Well, that's good, because it's time for me to get off the air anyway. So I want to thank everybody for listening and calling. And next week we're going to be talking about Project Hope, which is a plan to get every Oregonian universal health insurance. And we'll be talking with Lenny D., who is with Move On, or I try again, Onward Oregon, the Oregon's version of MoveOn.org. And we'll be talking briefly with Lenny about the campaign, and then we'll open it up to you and probably be talking about some other things as well. And we'll see if Karl Rove has been indicted by then. In the meantime, I want to go out with some one of my favorite Latin American songs by Soledad Bravo.
Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no quieres que llore? Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no voy a llorar? Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no quieres que llore? Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no voy a llorar? Ay, 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 si una sola vida tengo, pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no voy a llorar? pajarillo verde y me la quieren quitar. Ay, 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 si una sola vida tengo, pajarillo verde y me la quieren quitar. Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no quieres que llore? Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no voy a llorar? Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no quieres que llore? Pajarillo verde, ¿cómo no voy a llorar? Ay, 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 si los grillos te me quitan, pajarillo verde me los vuelven a pegar. Ay, 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 si los grillos te me quitan, pajarillo verde me los vuelven a pegar. Pajarillo verde, que limpio por más que sepa, pajarillo verde siempre dice la canilla. Pajarillo verde y el indio por más que sepa, pajarillo verde siempre dice la canilla. Ay, 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 pásame la cucharilla, pajarillo verde que está sobre la horqueta. Ay, 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 pásame la cucharilla, pajarillo verde que está sobre la
Good morning, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's time now for Veterans Voice. This morning the guest is activist Tom Hayden. At 10 o'clock on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Catherine Albrecht, author of the award-winning Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID, about advances in implementation of radio frequency identification technology at the consumer level. At 10:30, Andrew will interview, that's also Andrew Geller, will interview Dr. Azam Alwash, director of the Eden Again Project, which works to restore the marshlands of southern Iraq and Iran. And Jay Thiemeyer will review the work of Portland's Aurora Chorus, a group of powerful women singing peace. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, a comparison of the current NSA spy scandal with the Project Shamrock, the NSA spy scandal uncovered by the Church Committee in the 1970s, and the controversy over a new documentary film about the emergency room of a U.S. military hospital in Iraq. And now we begin the show for the vets